Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. Hey all, this was shot on location in lovely London in July. So watch out at the end for a link to Dr. Malhotra's excellent new book. And also I have a few minutes going through the GG compound, geraniol, that I mentioned during the interview. I'm here in Kensington, London, and I've met up again with Dr. Aseem Malhotra. Great to see you again, Aseem.
Always good to see you, mate.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about Aseem's new book, A Statin-Free Life, which sounds quite attractive to me, actually, but I am biased. But I think the key things, I've flicked through the book really fast. You just got me a review copy, and it's fantastic because it particularly explains everything so clearly for the layperson. You know, it's not just for doctors, etc. But the two big things are explaining all the cholesterol, the fat, the cholesterol lowering, and what the actual science is. And then it covers the statins, the side effects, the cost benefit, and, you know, gives people a guidance as to what they might do based on the science.
Absolutely. I think the heart of all of this is really cutting through the whole cholesterol hypothesis, helping people understand cholesterol better, why it may be a bad idea. In fact, I generally tell my patients that focusing on lowering cholesterol itself is essentially a waste of time. And in terms of their health, and obviously can come with potential harms depending how they do it, but also helping them understand whether or not a statin is right for them and helping them make an informed choice. So it's not really about don't take statins, although it's called statin-free life. But the reality is this, most people, when they're told, most people taking statins, if they are told their actual true benefits for them as an individual, most people would probably choose not to take the pill.
Yeah, exactly, because it's not an all or nothing, it's not a magical fix, though a lot of doctors do perceive them as kind of a magical fix.
Sure.
Here's your baggie of statins, you're done.
Yeah.
But of course, there's nothing like that. And we'll get into that shortly, but yeah. Maybe we'll start off with the first segment, because you've got to know the basics about cholesterol and its reality in health and disease, and the lowering of cholesterol. And would it be beneficial before you even get into the medication question?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you hit the nail on the head there, Ivor. We have to start from the basic understanding of, you know, this fear that's been created for several decades and imprinted on everyone's mind pretty much because it's been so effective in that public health messaging, if you like, of cholesterol, high cholesterol, right? People hear high cholesterol, go to the doctor, they get a test on high cholesterol. First thing they think about is heart attack. And that has been a very effective campaign to drive that fear. And there is a huge industry that supports that campaign, both the drug industry that have developed statin drugs, which are one of the most, if not the most lucrative drug in the history of medicine, but also the food industry. You know, a lot of low-fat foods proven to lower cholesterol. There's a huge market around that as well. So there's a lot of vested interest attached to this hypothesis, but we need to break down the hypothesis and try and understand, where did it come from? Why is it flawed? And why, as I argue in the book, should we be shifting to something more important when it comes to preventing and potentially even reversing heart disease? And that original associational data, which linked high cholesterol with heart disease, Ivor, actually came from the Framingham Heart Study, which started off in the 1940s in the US and followed people up, population people up from young adulthood into older age over several decades. And cholesterol was picked out as one of the risk factors for heart disease. But when you look at that data, and it's something that even you, you know, were well aware of many years ago when we discussed this, when you look at that original data, the association with heart disease and high cholesterol really was only at very high levels of cholesterol. We're talking about levels of, you know, over 300 milligrams per deciliter or more than 10 millimoles per liter. And
Or 5 millimoles approximately per liter.
No, as in that association.
Oh, right.
Of actually the strong association of heart disease was only at very high levels.
Mm.
When you look at total cholesterol below that, actually, you know, you couldn't tell whether someone is going to get heart disease or not based upon total cholesterol. It was looking at the total cholesterol divided by the HDL, the good cholesterol, the ratio. That was much more predictive. But what's happened is everyone, you know, over time, you're right, over time now, you will get a red mark on your blood test result if your total cholesterol is above 5.2 millimoles per liter. And that isn't really based upon any independent scientific evidence. This is more vested interest. It's over time, the threshold in terms of what was considered high cholesterol has been lowered more and more and more. And a lot of that has been based upon industry, pharmaceutical industry bias, scientists funded by them, the wrong hypothesis, a belief that the lower their cholesterol is, the better. And what I have done with my own research, as well as looking at other people's research in the space independent of any commercial influence, is we have determined, and we published something in BMJ Evidence-Based Medicine last year, myself and two cardiologists, I was second author on a paper, which basically showed that looking at drug trials with statins and even non-statin drugs, there was no correlation in lowering the so-called bad cholesterol, LDL, and reduction in heart attacks and strokes. No clear correlation. Which basically, and that looks at all of the evidence systematically, which essentially, in essence, says that it's basically nonsense. So lowering LDL for the purposes of preventing heart disease is not based upon any robust evidence whatsoever. In fact, it's been shown not to be effective.
Absolutely. And when you've shown something with contrary evidence to not be effective, no amount of associational studies suggesting a positive association can counteract that. When the hypothesis is kind of moribund or dead, that's it. Yeah. And actually, I misspoke because I was thinking of 5 millimoles of LDL specifically.
Oh, right. Sorry.
You were right. You were talking total.
Yeah.
And I think Castellia Framingham said that himself, that unless it's in the stratosphere, it has no independent predictive
power. I'm glad you mentioned that. So yeah, if we just both focus on LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, you're right. So William Castelli, one of the co-directors of Framingham, wrote a paper in 1996. In fact, you sent me that paper because I remember you mentioning it. And he said in there, unless your LDL was above 7.8 millimoles, it was effectively useless in predicting whether or not you're going to get heart disease. Mm. I think with more data, we've probably pushed that down slightly in a relevant way. And I've written in the book that actually it's probably about 4.9, which is still quite high. Above 4.9, you may have an increased risk of heart disease, but then there's further things that you can do to try and figure it out. And usually people who have an LDL, not a total cholesterol, above 4.9, most of those people have probably got something called familial hyperlipidemia, which is a genetic condition where you're born with genetically high levels of cholesterol, or LDL in particular, and affects about 1 in 250 people. But those people, which people, again, doctors will presume automatically, oh my God, you have a big risk of a heart attack, you should lower your LDL. Those people, about 70% of women and 50% of men, even with FH, will not develop any premature heart disease. Their risk is no different to anyone else. And that's really important and interesting because ultimately it's about reading, you know, as a doctor, what we want to be doing is treating the right patient with the right drug at the right time with, and this is lacking in medicine, unfortunately, truly informed consent. What do I mean by that? Well, if you look at, say, statin drugs, okay, which have been shown to be beneficial in protecting people from heart attacks and even early death in some cases, the best case scenario in people that have had a heart attack already, where there is some benefit, clear benefit, still reveals in those patients either a 1 in 39 benefit of it preventing a heart attack as an individual taking a statin who's had a heart attack already, and 1 in 83 chance in it delaying your death. And when you tell patients that, they're a bit surprised. They think it's a black and white issue or that their benefits would be much greater. When I ask them, what would you think or hope to be a benefit in taking a statin? Most of them think that their chances are almost 100% that it's going to benefit them. And the reality is that isn't the truth. That is not what the data tells us. So that then comes into the whole informed consent discussion. And if a patient wants to take a statin based upon those benefits, that's absolutely fine. If they decide not to, that's fine. But the third component, if you like, of the book is actually advocating for, irrespective of whether or not you're going to take a statin, do not neglect your metabolic health. And these are the lifestyle things that you can do to actually improve your metabolic health, which is at the root, really, the root cause of heart disease.
Absolutely. And I've often been kind of a little bit whimsical. And I've said to people, look, to be quite honest, I don't deny the positive effect of statins as shown in trials. But because they're so relatively small compared to what people perceive, and they don't actually stop or prevent a heart attack, they defer it by a certain time, which we might talk about in a moment.
Yeah.
It's not that the heart attack you would have had at 61, you now die in your sleep at 90, right? The heart attack you would have had at 61, you'll have a little later.
Yeah.
So that's the big problem.
Yeah.
But I often said that, from my read of the data in the global benefits, right, for a large amount of people. If you just eat one or two slices of bread less a day or skip that dessert occasionally, you'll probably match the benefit of a statin. Like, you don't have to do much to match the benefit of a statin, right?
Absolutely, and that's before we even get into the whole issue of side effects. But yeah, before we talk about side effects, the other thing to add, and why I say most people would choose not to take it. So if you haven't had a heart attack or have heart disease, then at best case scenario, a statin benefiting you from preventing a minor, a non-fatal heart attack, so it's not going to prolong your life, that's what people need to understand, is about 1 in 100, 1% over a five-year period, okay? And that, again, you know, studies have been shown when they actually fully inform patients in these scenarios of any drug and say, what would you, you know, what is the sort of distribution of people that would take a drug with that kind of benefit versus the ones that wouldn't? The majority of people, when given that choice, and that's before we even talk about side effects, you just talk about benefit, presume there's no side effects, most people would decide not to take the pill. Yet, most people around the world, and it is estimated that about a billion people in the world, you know, hundreds of millions at least, but up to maybe a billion people in the world are prescribed statin drugs. Most of those people, if they knew exactly what the true benefit is was for them, would choose not to take it, which is it's a mess. It's a complete mess. You know, it's about ethics. It's about informed consent. It's about what should we be doing instead or in addition to potentially taking the statin. Mm. And that's what the book tries to address, really. This isn't just about statins. This is about ethical, evidence-based medical practice. It's actually about what we should really be doing. And for me, primarily as a cardiologist, I care about heart disease more than anything else. How can we really curb heart disease properly and reverse it?
Exactly. And it just brings to mind what you mentioned there. There is, it's only one study, but it's from top guys in the field. I can't recall the name right now. And it was looking at calcium scan results. And the people who had high calcium scores, the statin showed a reasonable benefit, but it was still a number needed to treat of around 50. So 50 people need to take the drug for one to benefit with a deferral, not with magic.
Yeah.
And then the zero scoring people in there, it was somewhere in the region of one in 500
there was no
to
benefit,
zero.
Essentially.
To zero.
Yeah.
So we have all of this massive over-treatment of people who will not even benefit.
Exactly.
That's the horrifying
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. And then, you know, we get into the whole issue, and I see this with my own patients, the illusion of protection. So there are people out there, even very well-educated people, and this is not their fault. This is the misinformation actually starts with the practitioner, with the doctor. So I talk about, you know, we have an epidemic of misinformed doctors and misinformed patients, right? So this book also is actually also aimed at, as well as the public, is also to educate doctors as well. But the illusion of protection is they think that if they take their statin, they can basically eat what they want. And everything is, the diet is related to cholesterol, and cholesterol causes heart disease. So therefore, if I'm getting my cholesterol low with a drug, I can eat what I want. Nothing could be further from the truth, Ivan, nothing. You could actually be increasing a net harm if you are a doctor prescribing a statin. In essence, you could be potentially giving them a statin drug, not educating them about diet and lifestyle, and they've got the illusion of protection from the statin. They end up developing type 2 diabetes because they're eating junk food, ultra-processed food. In that scenario, hypothetically, you're actually causing a net harm to that patient, not a benefit.
Yeah, and that's absolutely, and it happens in many walks of life where an illusion of protection puts you in the line of fire.
Yeah.
But now we're talking tens, hundreds of millions, not just small numbers of people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So on the harms then, this is very controversial, and I know you've spoken many times, and I've been in venues where I've recorded you speaking and released the videos, but the harms of statins, the industry and Sir Rory Collins and the people who are funded all talk about sub 1%, it's a small thing, rare events, blah, blah, blah. But the real evidence is it's much higher. And I must say anecdotally, and I know it's anecdotal, but anecdotal verifies it's vastly bigger than they claim.
Yeah. So both, I mean, I originally got into this space either because of my own experience with patients, seeing people in the National Health Service and having managed thousands of heart patients over the years, I noticed a lot of them on statins were having problems. And I thought, this is strange because there's a discrepancy between the side effects they seem to be reporting and what we're told in the clinical trial data, which, you know, as you're absolutely right, less than 1% may get muscle symptoms or muscle aches or fatigue, which is the most common of the side effects. But the reason why there's a discrepancy is those trials are designed in a way, either they they figured out early on. They knew which are the types of people that would like to get side effects. And I cover this in the book. So if people want to look at that, there's a nice section where I actually give all the different organs that may be affected by statins, or the, more importantly, actually, the types of people that are more likely to get side effects. But when you look at it and add it all up, it's more than half the population. So, you know, if you're over 75, if you have a vitamin D deficiency, if you're female, if you're South Asian, you know, there's loads of people that come into this category of being at risk of side effects. But to answer your question, it is controversial in terms of how true the prevalence of side effects are, because you're right, some of it may be people imagining the symptoms, or some of it could be genuine, but you can always do things as a doctor to work out which one it likely is. It's probably anywhere in the region of 10 to 15%, maybe up to 30, 40, even 50%. At some point, taking a statin will experience a side effect that interferes with the quality of their life. And that's a crucial point. So I've got to be very honest and upfront, you know, statin side effects are not life-threatening, but, you know, they are mostly in life, you know, quality of life interfering. And that's important, because someone's feeling miserable and walking around and aching or feeling fatigued. No one wants to live like that. And that's the most common side effect of statins, is muscle pain and fatigue. The good news is, usually, if you stop the statin for a few weeks, the side effects disappear. And that's a good test sometimes to work out whether the statin is the cause or something else.
And actually, the acid test in engineering problem solving is switch it off and see things improve, and then switch it on again, see them disapprove.
Yes.
And I know many cases of that also, where people have dipped back in.
Yes.
Interestingly, a very close relation of mine in his 60s, super blood profile, but an LDL around 5 and a total around 8 millimoles or 300 milligrams for Americans, had statins, 80 milligram Lipitor. And after a couple of years, he was very active, used to go mountain climbing, walking, began to get to the point where he couldn't even comfortably go for walks. And asked me, began to see my stuff. I explained to him, look, the risk reduction is very small anyway. Let's be honest, informed. And I also said, you have a beautiful blood profile. He had 4.6 glucose, really low liver enzymes. He was super slim and really fit. So his cholesterol ratios were beautiful. So he actually never had a cholesterol problem. But I explained that to him and he went off them. A few weeks later, his phrase was, he said it twice to me, intently. I said, well, how has it gone since you dropped them? And he says, Ivor, I got my life back. I got my life back.
Yeah.
And he was intense about it.
Yeah.
It was life-changing in a positive way.
Yes.
And he's just one of many, many people. And it never came back. The problem never came back. And he never actually did go on them, as that happens. He just never touched them again.
Yeah.
He was a technical guy too. And once he got it, he got it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a way through all of this for every practitioner and doctor, is just practice according to the principles of evidence-based medicine, which is very straightforward and makes a lot of sense, which is you use the best available evidence. And this is where there's obviously a bit of controversy, because a lot of what's being considered the best available evidence is essentially industry biased, industry corrupted research, okay? So I look at the totality of the evidence, and your own clinical, as a doctor, your own experience and knowledge of patients. But the third, and that's the most important actually, Ivor, in this, and I think most of the public and patients would agree to this, or be happy that this is being, you know, spoken about, is taking into consideration personal patient preferences and values, right? That's what we call true informed consent. The problem we've got is a lot of patients, there's fear mongering. There are doctors, you know, people come to me for second opinions quite often, who I see privately, and they are telling me stories of other doctors, and it's quite sad, and I really feel for them, where they're literally effectively being told off that they don't want to take a statin, and they're literally being shouted at. Yeah. And that is totally inappropriate. It's not going to give you a good patient outcome. It's not the way you should be talking to patients. But it's very common. And I don't think, actually, the intent of that particular doctor is malicious in any way. But they are so indoctrinated. They are so indoctrinated that, you know, even they think they're being objective.
Yeah.
Right? And they think they're doing the right thing. And they think that if they don't coerce or really scare the patient taking a statin, the patient's going to drop dead from a heart attack. You just need to take a step back, take a few deep breaths, look at what the data says, have that conversation with the patient. It might still be your opinion that you want the patient to tell you, I recommend it. But give them that information. If the patient says, no, actually, doc, I'd prefer not to, is there an alternative? And I think that's another barrier, is at least when I have speak to my patients, I will give them the alternative as well around the lifestyle stuff that they can be doing. And a lot of doctors, and this is because it's not something we learn in medical school, most of them have no clue in even basic understanding of what a healthy diet is and how lifestyle factors can rapidly improve risk markers, you know, that affect your heart disease risk.
And that's absolutely true. I have heard countless stories of where the doctor said, basically, look, the diet stuff is nonsense. So they've actually been educated to believe profoundly that the diet stuff doesn't really do much. And simultaneously, they honestly believe, as you said, that the medical or the drugs are kind of miracle drugs.
Yeah.
So they're profoundly wrong on both sides of the equation, which is a disaster for public health, of course. Now, in terms of what you can do, the people who, and I understand and I've met many of them, they say, look, I know it's only a small risk, but they're kind of terrified of heart attacks or their parent died very young.
Of course.
So they just want to keep taking them.
Yeah.
And there's not much you can do really to counteract side effects of statin because it's a chemical effect. I guess you can improve your metabolic health and then you'll genuinely be lowering your risk. One, probably 20 times more than a statin if you do it right. But also you'll probably mitigate the side effects maybe if you get very healthy. Though I'm not sure we have cases of that.
No, sure. I know some people take coenzyme Q10. They come to me and they say that helped. If there is something, I mean, I'm in general, I'm one that is usually, I think, you know, we've used it quite a lot in medicine where sometimes we prescribe another one drug to counteract the side effects of another drug they're taking. Quite often that happens with things like aspirin and people get a bit of stomach issues. So we give them an antacid tablet, like a proton pump inhibitor. And that's quite common, actually. But if there was something people, you know, I completely agree though, Ivor, there are people that, especially the heart disease risk people, most of them probably would carry on taking the statin. A few of them wouldn't, given that information. And if they are getting side effects, but they still want to take the statin, there's a few options. One is they can lower the dose. If there's something else they can take, like coenzyme Q10 or something else, right, that can help them, then I think that's fine. I think the key is, you know, informed choice, help the patient in whatever way you can with whatever tools you've got. But again, yeah, add the lifestyle stuff in on top of it. Make sure it's not the illusion of protection. That's all.
Well, actually, that was kind of a slightly cheeky question because I do know of something and only very recently. So I work with Warren of Extend Life. He owns a manufacturing plant in New Zealand. He's a buddy of mine. And also I've interviewed Dr. Barry Tan, who's a kind of a brilliant PhD kind of biochemist. And GG, did you ever hear of GG?
I haven't heard of it now.
So GG is geraniol. It's a fundamentally massively important molecule in the body.
Right.
But for people who are watching who have heard of the mevalonate pathway, which you certainly, and you've covered it in the book. So the statin goes in this cholesterol producing pathway, the mevalonate, and it knocks off a whole branch of the tree. And part of that is cholesterol. So you get your cholesterol lowering, so happy days. But it also knocks out a whole lot of other stuff leading to the muscle pain, etc. Now, the reason it appears it does that is it knocks out the geraniol pathway, which is a key intermediary biochemical in that pathway. And if you supplement with GG, GG is required for muscle repair. It's required for CoQ10 usage.
Right.
And it's required for hormone production and multiple other things. So when the statin knocks out the cholesterol, it's knocking out all this other stuff. And GG appears to be at the nexus of all that damaging problem. And luckily, it's available now as an actual supplement. So people can fix the pathway that's been knocked out by statin while still allowing the statin to keep their cholesterol lower. If they believe that is useful, it's another option.
Yeah. And Ivor, on that point, I think what's important, I mentioned in the book as well. So if lowering LDL cholesterol doesn't do any effect, how do statins work? And statins are known to have an anti-inflammatory, slight anti-inflammatory, and anti-thrombotic, anti-clotting effect. So my personal view, looking at all the data, is the likely benefits of statins are not because of lowering LDL cholesterol. They're because of this slight anti-inflammatory, anti-clotting effect. And that's how they probably, in a small way, in people with heart disease, very high risk, have some benefit.
And quite a few publications on that. I know the pleiotropic, so-called pleiotropic effect, but there's a lot of good science that actually backs that up.
Yeah.
But luckily again with GG, that also will leave that remaining or pleiotropic effect will remain that acting.
Absolutely.
But one I forgot as well, GG also is intimately involved in, guess what? K2 metabolism.
Oh, interesting.
So what actually comes downstream of geraniol is CoQ10, muscle repair mechanisms, hormone creation, including testosterone, and K2 metabolism, okay. MK4.
So it boosts testosterone as well, does it?
It will repair some of the damaged pathways from the statin. Now, this has not got RCTs yet because only pharma can afford RCTs.
Yeah, but it's just... sounds very interesting, yeah.
It was funny when I saw all of the old favorites that we talk about all the time. They're all in there. So I'll show it on the screen, the pathways afterwards. But, you know, we'll see. We need to do more field trials and all that, but we'll see how we get on with
it. Fantastic.
So your book, basically, A Statin-Free Life, covers... Essentially, as I scan through it, it covers all the cholesterol, the fat nonsense that drove
saturated
that.
Saturated fat, sugar, all that.
All of that, the lowering of cholesterol and whether or not that will benefit, the statin efficacy, numbers needed to treat, and the simplified mathematics of what the benefit really is so you can be informed.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the side effects and all the published data on side effects.
Yeah. It's a very comprehensive breakdown, easy to read, take it through it written in a logical way. I mean, I think I've tried to do it in the most sort of precise and logical way to cover all of this quite complex topic for many people. And then either, again, touching on calcium scores, which I know you're something you're very interested in, which I think has a potentially huge role to play for a lot of people. And then the evidence on heart disease reversal, which is interesting. So I think the new sort of focus, a new shift, what we need to be now talking about is how can we potentially reverse heart disease or even stop it in its tracks. And there's a good amount of evidence out there that it is very viable and very possible. The only controversy is how do we best achieve it. I think I've covered the lifestyle stuff separate to diet. I mean, the diet stuff's in there as well. I think the controversy is about which diet. Is it a low-fat vegan diet? Is it low carb? Whatever. I've covered that. And what my personal view is in terms of the evidence that's there. But the key element that we've, looking at in terms of heart disease reversal appears to be, in that specific group, stress reduction. You know, once you've covered the basis of getting the diet right, the moderate activity, the stress reduction may be the most important thing to help reverse heart disease.
And
through meditation, basically.
Yeah, and that's one that I have less information on. But what I do have is stress linkage to elevated glucose, elevated insulin, elevated cortisol.
Absolutely.
So all the mechanistic is there. But of course,
it's pro-inflammatory as well. You see, and we know
immune disease, system interaction.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And the only question is, of course, quantifying stress versus drinking Coca-Cola versus smoking.
Absolutely.
But I'm happy enough that it's one key element.
Yes.
And it's in the basket.
And it's something that, it's not something we should ignore. So the other things are so important.
Sleep as well, which links to stress intimately.
Absolutely. So all the patients that come to me as well, I really emphasize, and it's interesting, invariably either, the people that have suffered heart attacks that come and see me, when I get onto the discussion of stress, invariably, their levels of stress over the previous few years, not just about the heart attack and how they felt about that, because obviously that can be quite a traumatic experience. It is a very traumatic experience for people to suffer a heart attack. But invariably, their stress levels are above 7 or 8 out of 10 over the last few years, very, very high. Some of them even who are otherwise very fit, obsessive exercises. I saw a guy recently in his late 40s, super fit guy, six pack, all that kind of stuff, trying to figure out why he had a heart attack, got onto stress and sleep. I said, how many hours of sleep have you, busy guy with his work, how many hours of sleep have you averaged over the last 5 years? On average, 4 hours of sleep a night. Boom, right? Yeah. Super stressed, for him. There were other things, bad luck or whatever, but that was a huge, without a doubt, a huge component that, caused him to have a heart attack in his 40s. So we've got it's one area that's been neglected, and it's one area that I give a plan about how we can approach this for individuals, but also within the NHS.
Yeah. Oh, no, I absolutely agree. And I remember when we put the list of things to do, myself and Dr. Gerber in our book, we had the four S's. It's years ago, but I remember there was sun, sleep, stress, and supplements. And we were acknowledging that magnesium and K2 and D3, a few key supplements, minerals that are now gone out of. I mean, what's stunning to me is magnesium is so central. And an RCT with magnesium, just magnesium oxide intervention in kidney patients who are all diabetic, obviously, that's why they have heart disease problems, tracked them for 2 years, magnesium oxide high dose versus none, and the difference in calcification progression was astounding.
Wow.
I mean, it was literally 11...
Coronary calcification.
Coronary calcification, CT scan.
Very interesting.
In 2 years, the magnesium oxide or CT,
yeah.
not associational,
yeah.
single intervention. The magnesium oxide progressed at 11% per year average, and below 15 is generally accepted to be very low risk of progression.
Sure.
And the other group, when nothing was done, 41% progression, which is well into the dangerous.
Imagine. Was a postulated mechanism through stress reduction? What did they, how did they conclude
that? That team was looking at the actual interaction with magnesium in the calcification process.
Interesting.
And they were also looking at magnesium is in around 300 metabolic reactions in the body. So there's a general importance of having magnesium.
Right.
And it's estimated maybe 80% of people are effectively insufficient. And remember, all our water that we used to get from springs and everything, that's gone. And the water we get from the tap. There's another thing about magnesium that the vegetables, and this one struck me 3-4 years ago, the US Department of Agriculture came out with a shocking report, and they showed that the content of vegetables, magnesium content, had gone down around a factor of 8 over 40 years. And that's modern agriculture. The soil gets magnesium depleted. And imagine it's gone from its original rates or content down to around 13 or 15% of what it was.
Right. Wow.
That's just based on modern aquaculture. That's not based on toxins or any crazy stuff. So it just shows you such an important element, but no one is worried about it. They all want to go down and get their statin, that's why. That's it. I think excellent book. So Statin-Free Life, and I'll be able to release this podcast when it's ready to be released.
Yes. Brilliant. Awesome, mate. Great chat.
Great
to you
stuff,
always.
The same. And we might go for a cocktail tonight, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm in London. Why
I think,
not?
I think we should. I'll take you to...
No masks.
Yeah. Absolutely. No masks. That's true. And,
nothing.
And I'll take you to a fun place.
Great stuff.
All right.
Bye now. But I did mention there the geraniol. And I have a long podcast with Dr. Barry Tan going through all the details, but I just thought I'd give you some here. And again, it's working in conjunction with my buddy, Warren Matthews of Extend Life in New Zealand. I was over there and he's been over in Ireland. And we're very excited about this really new product, which will counter, to a large extent, we believe, the negative effects of this drug class, but without affecting its claimed positive effects, i.e. the lowering of cholesterol. The principle is illustrated simply here from the product leaflet. So as you can see here, the mevalonate pathway, which is so crucial for cholesterol synthesis, and also has GG as an interim step in promoting the manufacture of all of these critical components. And there's some detail there on the left. The problem with the drug class of statins is that it kind of uses a sledgehammer. And it pretty much knocks out a lot more than is really intended originally. So sure, the cholesterol lowering for the potential benefits there, and some anti-clotting perhaps, and pleiotropic, as Dr. Malhotra pointed out, but also knocks out the crucial component of geraniol. And this then leads to many of the problems associated with the drug class. One solution for those who continue to wish taking the medications for their preventative effect is to supplement with the geraniol directly, therefore reinvigorating this pathway post the effect of the statins and negating some of the negative effects. And those include CoQ10 manufacture, vitamin K2 and MK4 metabolism, muscle repair, and other hormone manufacture. And as it happens, like other products I featured before, I do have a discount code for GG Pure because of my relationship with Warren and Extend Life. And again, this does help me a little to keep the train on the track, so to speak. And of course, you can go elsewhere, and there are a couple of other sources of this compound in the world. So you're free to go elsewhere or just go with diet, lifestyle, and keep taking the drugs if you wish. And not go this route of counteracting the negative effects. And that's fine too.
It's all about personal choice. There are options for those who want to go that bit further.